Hi everyone. Well, it's been much longer than I anticipated, and for that I apologise. A very belated Happy New Year to all of you. But though much time has elapsed, I had considered dividing today's episode into two. You can choose yourselves if you want to listen to it as a two-parter, and that may make up for some of the time lost. I had the pleasure of speaking to Professor Leandro Prados de la Escosura. He is professor at the University of Madrid in Economic History. He's a research fellow at the Centre of Economic Policy Research, and anyone who has worked with long-run numbers of GDP, particularly for Spain or Latin America, is already very familiar with his work. Leandro has published two renowned books, one on Spanish economic growth between 1850 and 2015, and that was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. And his most recent effort was Human Development and the Path to Freedom. That was published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. While today's conversation was quite long, I think it's fair to say that we really only scratched the surface of Leandro's body of work. We focused on three discussion papers published by the Centre of Economic Policy Research, the first of which is called Economic Freedom in Retrospect. That was a discussion paper of 2023. The second paper is called Health, Income and the Preston Curve, a long view, and that was put out in 2022 by the CEPR. And the final paper, in which we discuss inequality, we use his paper, Inequality Beyond GDP, a Long Run View. And that was published in 2021, again by the CEPR discussion paper series. I hope you all have a nice weekend, and I'll see you all soon. So Leandro, thank you very much for agreeing to do this with us. Before we get into today's topic, could you start off by telling us how you got into economic history in the first place?
Well, thank you very much, Sean. It's a great pleasure being here with you. Let me start by telling you that when I finished my degree, in those days it was a 5-year degree in economics, in 1973, I decided to become an academic, and actually what Kuznets called modern economic growth, or we would call development, was my favorite field. Mind you that in those days, development economics was less technical than it is, less rigorous than it is today. Was macro, not micro. Was dynamic, or had a time dimension unlike today. But then I realized that in Spain in those days, the best people looking at the long run were a handful of economic historians. So that's why I started, you know. And I remember, you know, in those days, I came across Sir John Hicks, A Theory of Economic History, you know. Now perhaps you would find, again, economists writing about economic history, such as Acemoglu. But for many years, economists wouldn't bother. And Hicks wrote something about economic history that I didn't like at the time. He said, a major function of economic history is to be a forum where, you know, political scientists, historians, economists meet and talk to each other. And I thought, this is too bland. You know, I was thinking on a, you know, more in a cliometric sense. But then, you know, with age, I realized that he was right, because in economic history, we address historical topics that usually go beyond the boundaries of economics, and this is the fun about it, and use the tools of economics, and not only of economics, but basically of economics. So I think he had the right approach. So, you know, my relationship with economic history has changed. You know, now I have a broader view than initially. This also is related to the issue of how was economic history at the time I entered the field? And I'm talking about starting in those days. I mentioned in our previous conversation that there were people in Britain who didn't finish their PhDs because they got a job immediately after. The same happened in Spain. You know, I was 22 when I finished my degree, and I started teaching at university, you know, with my BSc in economics. So I started teaching in 73, 74, the first academic year. And that year is important in economic history because it was Fogel and Engerman's Time on the Cross publication year. But previously, I had bought a book edited by Peter Temin, The New Economic History, which was an amazing collection of papers. So you can imagine that in those days, slavery, counterfactuals, they were terms that were part of my vocabulary. But at the same time, even though I was always very sympathetic and to geometrics, I realized more and more that in Europe, economic history had other roots. I mean, think, for instance, of Dean and Cole, British Economic Growth, which is, a masterpiece. In fact, Steve Broberry, Bruce Campbell have continued that tradition. So it's 60 years later, Dean and Cole still is a must. Or think of Habakkuk, also a book from 1962, comparing American and British technology. There was a different approach. And in addition, coming from Spain, that was becoming a middle-income country in the 70s, I also realized that economic history for a non-advanced country was much more informative about the current challenges and much less alien, so to speak, to the present. So economists, professional economists, academic economists, non-economic historians would find interesting our discussions. So economic history was much more a live subject than in Britain or in the US. So this is the context in which I started.
And you mentioned a few there, Leandro, in terms of books or papers. You had Dean and Cole in there, you had a few. Were they the major ones that inspired you, or was there one in particular that stood out?
Obviously, Dean and Cole was very important for my work. But at this time, in the early 70s, economic history was booming, not only because of the geometric revolution that had started in the late 50s, but because there was a renaissance of economic history in Europe. Think that your own Irish Economic History Review was started in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. Gianni Toniolo revived Luigi Naudi's Rivista Historia Economica. Gabriel Tortella started Revista Historia Economica in the early 1980s. So there was, and the French had a new journal that was in addition to Annales. So it was at a very productive time. So perhaps I should choose books that were influential in my work. One of them, a classical, would be Gershenkron's collection of essays, Economic Backwardness in Historical Perspective. Another one that was crucial was Patrick O'Brien, with the collaboration of Jacques Larquet there, Economic Growth in Britain and France, Two Paths to the 20th Century. And there is a third one that I mentioned in our previous conversation, which is Arthur Lewis, Growth and Fluctuations, 1870-1930. What they have in common is that Gershenkron was stressing how different the initial conditions of development are for latecomers compared to early starters, and how these conditions will develop. Patrick O'Brien, which was the main author of this book on hierarchy there, it's a path-breaking book for two reasons. One is because of his bold approach. He's challenging the view that was quite popular, Kindleberger book on France and Britain, and especially David Landes' Unbound Prometheus, had this idea that the British Industrial Revolution was not the first, but was the best example of industrialization. So set the path. And you could say that one way of assessing the success or failure of another country was to use the template from the British Industrial Revolution, and to the extent it matched it fit the template. It was a success. Otherwise, it was a failure. Some people suggested that it was has to do with David Landes' experience in post-Second World War Europe. He was in France at the time. But this was quite influential, you know. So Patrick O'Brien is challenging that and saying, well, there is nothing in economic theory that tells you that countries having different institutions, initial institutions, and different factor endowments, and therefore relative factor and commodity prices, should follow the same path. And he was very interested on well-being. And at the same time, it was a pioneer work because he was following Irving Cravey's and the young Summers and Heston people doing PPP adjustments. So it's the first time then in economic history. It was a very, very rough exercise with only a handful of commodities, but he was trying to do PPP comparisons. And the third book mentioned is Arthur Lewis. Arthur Lewis was also trying to see how there was a variety of reactions in the periphery to industrialization in the core. There are articles, and there's very important articles that I would add as well. But one of these interesting articles was written by the late Nick Craft that was called Why Was England First? And this article was written when he was in his 20s, you know, in 1976. And it was also a challenge of previous preconceptions, you know. But I think Patrick was the first one in the 70s who said, look, we cannot go on just using this template. And for me, it was a very important. I mentioned all these three books because I allocated a large part of my research to work on my own country in Spain and then on Latin America. And in Latin America, I discovered that the same self-defeating approach as in Europe. In Europe was using Britain as a template, was the US as a template for Latin America. I mean, what happened in the 13 North American colonies of Britain, which is the east of the present-day US, was the template to assess Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, I mean, you name it. And obviously, you have Engerman and Sokolov essays in which, obviously, the Latin America is always on the wrong foot. But what's the point to compare Latin America to the 13 colonies of? Wouldn't it be better to compare Peru to India and Brazil to Nigeria that had similar climate, similar factor endowments, and they were also colonies?
So we'll turn now to today's topic, which is sort of the work that you've been doing in recent years. Obviously, you've done a lot more work than what we're going to talk about today, but today we've just picked this topic as alternatives to GDP, even though you've spent a lot of your career doing exactly GDP and productivity and things. I thought we'd take a look at your recent kind of trend, which is looking at well-being and liberty and things like that. So before we get into today's topic, can you explain why you were interested in alternatives to GDP, in measuring well-being, and what general questions you were interested in answering?
Let me say that, economic growth, for me, like for you, is a major topic of interest. And it has been a major topic of interest for me since I was an undergraduate. And furthermore, I've allocated a substantial part of my academic career to studying long-run economic performance. So, and I have also dedicated many years to the reconstruction of historical national accounts. So I have nothing against that, on the contrary. However, GDP, and this is something that Kuznets in the early 50s, when he was have already done his major work on the US, tried to warn us. GDP is so handy, so convenient as a synthetic index with some remote backing by economic theory that is tempting to use it as a proxy of well-being. In fact, is correlated with some indicators of well-being. But I wasn't persuaded because it was just simply convenient, because I thought well-being goes beyond just material progress without, you know, all the caveats you can introduce about the extent to which GDP captures material progress. And I became interested in about 30 years ago or more, in a way of addressing well-being, because well-being beyond GDP has been a recurring topic since modern national accounts were created. Yes, from the beginning, there were people dissatisfied. But different alternative approaches fail one after another. And the one which has lasted, not without criticism, obviously, is the human development approach inspired by Amartya Sen's capabilities approach, that for me was particularly appealing because it puts freedom at the center, because its main idea is enlarging people's choices. And also I felt tempted to do historical research, because even though the index proposed, which was a reduction of the concept, obviously on the basis of very gross information. But the index wasn't, in my view, faithful to this idea of enlarging people's choices, because I remember in the first publication, 1990, I was looking at my own country, Spain, and there were some kind of retrospect statistics going back to 75. In 75, Spain appeared in the first quartile, and I said, how come? We were living under Franco, under a dictatorship. How come? And it was because they have forgotten about freedom. And that's what triggered my interest in saying, well, I can reconstruct this, and I can add something that is missing in the empirical application of the concept of human development.
So since the time of Smith and Mill, we've heard about how important the concept of liberty is in economics. Can you explain to us why it is so important and why you think it's worth measuring?
I agree with you. I mean, I think freedom is important in economics. It's the most important thing we have. You know? And I would say that freedom as absence of coercion and interference by others is the conventional nowadays called the negative definition of liberty. And this view of freedom as absence of coercion and interference by others goes back, as you rightly say, to Mill and Smith, but even further back, you could trace it to Hume, who stresses the right of property as a foundation of society, or even the 17th century to Locke, who emphasized freedom of association, private property, and an individual liberty under the rule of law. So, you know, there is a long tradition. More recently, I mean, there was a masterpiece that Isaiah Berlin wrote for his inaugural lecture at Oxford, in which he introduces positive freedom as freedom to, as opposed to negative freedom from. And it also connects with roles. And this is the idea that freedom, positive freedom, is freedom that allows individuals to have access to resources, to goods and services that allow them to develop their potential and to enjoy freedom, to be, as Berlin used to say, being masters of their own life. So these two views have seen, in my personal opinion, as two views in conflict. Many libertarians would think that positive freedom is theft. You know, positive freedom is someone is taking money out of your pocket. And there is this tension, you know, it has existed between two views. One view that the most effective way of promoting welfare and equity would be to increase freedom. And the less optimistic view that welfare and equity or equality are prerequisites of freedom. So it would be, you know, when you go have elections, those who vote liberal in the European sense and those who vote social democrat parties, who would be the pessimists. So, but there is this tension. So what was my concern was, is this conflict that we perceive in daily life, does it exist when you look at the long run? Is this apparent trade-off between freedom, negative and positive freedom, holds over time or only holds in different periods? Or they evolve alongside? And the only way to solve it is, I mean, unless you're a philosopher, and I am a number cruncher, is to go and collect the data and trying to do it. And so I decided to do it in two steps. One was working on the positive part of freedom, which is, you know, my book, Human Development, The Path of Freedom, the final outcome, even though I couldn't split negative and positive freedom there, because I'm using civil and political liberties, and you have civil liberties are negative freedom and political liberties are positive freedoms, so to speak. So, and now I'm back to economic freedom. But let me tell you that years ago, I published in the Economic History Review a paper on economic freedom. And a friend of mine, a good economist friend of mine, who's a libertarian, said to me, "Oh, well done, well done. You have built up the first social democratic index of economic freedom I know." And I'll tell you in a minute why.
And you've attempted to estimate liberty through time for a number of countries. What are the components of your liberty index? I think you mentioned some of them. And why did you choose these as important representations of liberty?
Firstly, something I haven't put in writing, but I think is, we talked about freedom and in economics. I mean, freedom is absence of coercion and interference by others. So this is an individual issue. It's a negative. Freedom is individual. So any attempt to build up a macro index obviously can be challenged on the basis that we're jumping from the individual to the group or to the society. So you have to compromise. And this is what I, as a good eclectical social scientist, I've done. You could say, well, to the extent that country can be considered free or unfree, you would say that a country is free from an economic perspective when basically property is privately owned and protected, contracts are enforced, there is price stability, barriers to trade, domestic and international, are small, and resources are mainly allocated through the market. And there is a long list, but this is what comes to my mind more easily. And this is the closest thing in empirical terms is the Fraser Institute Economic Freedom of the World Index. That includes, you know, these dimensions of property rights in the legal system, price stability, international openness to factor and commodity mobility, and freedom from the kind of regulation that hampers individuals' decision. And they also added size of government. And this is the hot issue for which I was accused of building a social democratic index. In the Fraser Institute, you could also drop what they call sound money, the price stability, because with legal and system and property, international openness and lack of regulation would be enough. But the size of government, this is something in which I have a strong disagreement with libertarian people. I was having a conversation not long ago with one of the bosses of the Cato Institute about that. I mean, the idea they have to include the size of government is a sensible one, in the sense that the more a society relies on private initiative and on the market, and the less on government intervention, the freer is the society. But you have to make a distinction between being an anarchist and being a liberal. If you are an anarchist, you don't need the state at all, you know. But it's freedom under the law, not freedom in the absence of government, because the government has the monopoly since Locke. This is the idea that government has the monopoly of violence. And if you want to guarantee freedom, that includes the provision of law and order, defense, protection of property rights and contract enforcement, and so on and so forth, you need taxation, you need borrowing, you need issuing money. So at the end of the day, from a historical perspective, is not so much the size of government, but the nature of government action. And I'll go back to my own country. Under Franco's Spain, the size of government, measured either by expenditure, the proportion of public expenditure in GDP, or the proportion of government revenues in GDP, was tiny. We were like a Latin American country or maybe an African country. And now we are a Scandinavian country in that respect. Does it mean that we are less free from coercion and interference in our economic decisions than we were under Franco? Certainly not. But this is something that historians have known for a long time. I remember, you know, when Martin Cecco many years ago was saying, look, historical evidence for Europe shows that centralization, fiscal centralization, which is related to increased taxation, is highly correlated to parliamentary control of public spending, because obviously people wouldn't pay more taxes unless they have a say. Or John Wallis and North and Wenger, when they say, you know, at the end of the day, the provision of government public goods lowers the cost of market participation. And then if you go to the empirical evidence and you think, for instance, in important papers written by Tim Leslie, you realize that often small-sized government countries are just weak fiscal states. I mean, because collecting taxes, you know, usually under democracy and under freedom, it's easier to collect taxes because people pay taxes willingly. And Hayek, you know, who's not suspicious of being left-wing or was a socialist, Hayek stressed in the Constitution of Liberty that if people decide freely to raise their taxes, there is no reduction in individual freedom. If it's something that is done willingly, and it's important that governments have rules that are clear and understood and for general purposes. I mean, it's very often the case in developing countries with small governments that governments' policies are unpredictable. Predictability is crucial. I mean, if you know these are the rules, then you know how to behave. So, well, I'm sorry for the long digression, but I think it's important in our days to make this distinction that it's not the size, it's the nature of government policies. And as you know, in these days in which liberal democracies is challenged, it's good to go back and think that for many years there was a tension among philosophers, political philosophers, and for instance, between democracy and freedom. We live in a tiny part of the world. We live in a very delicate system called liberal democracy, in which we have the best of both worlds, because democracy is the rule of the majority. It's about who who's going to rule. So when people talk nowadays of illiberal democracy, no, this is simply democracy. We live in liberal democracy, which is when, in addition to the rule of the majority, you have this other view, which is the liberal approach in which you keep an eye on the government. You try to reduce the interference of government on individual decisions.
Yeah.
Individual decisions that are related to the freedom to decide what is best for them, not the action of government in general. So this idea of having a check on government and how you elect the government are two different things that in our societies are intertwined. But this is a kind of miracle. So this is no longer, it was not the case probably in the 1930s in most of the world, is not the case in most of the world nowadays. When we do historical research, I think it's important to keep in mind these big ideas.
Having discussed your construction of the Liberty Index, what are the periods that you saw in your work of the major gains and the major losses? What were there any surprises in your results?
Yes, thanks. First of all, it's up to you to decide to the extent these results are surprising or not to you and to people who take a look at the paper. You know, as I said before, I wrote a paper published in the Economic History Review paper, you know, 8 years ago. But having, once I'm back on economic freedom and its relationship with everything else, I have started again from scratch. And obviously, when you start from scratch, but mostly from scratch, you change some of the results. So what I have now is instead of, as I did in the previous research on economic human development, I'm not focusing on 100 and 160 countries. I'm focusing on OECD, on a sample of OECD countries, those who were part of OECD before the early 90s. Why? Because since there are different components, you need, they're delicate issues, you need the best possible data. So I thought I had this you know, dilemma of covering many countries and then having to oversimplify a lot, or just focusing on a few countries. And even as I said before, we are already simplifying, going from individual freedom to countries' societies' freedom. That was already an oversimplification to insist on that. So I took 21 countries. In the OECD, basically what you would call the Atlantic economy, Western Europe, Japan, Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand, from 1850 to 2020. And I would say that so far, because I'm still working on it, there's some findings. The first one is that over the last 170 years, you would say that it has been a sustained gain in economic freedom. But this is far from steady. There are ups and downs. But on the whole, you would say that, I mean, this is a technical issue, but how can you measure improvements in a bounded variable such as an index, you know, that goes from 0 to 10, for instance, or 0 to 1? Well, the best thing to do this is to measure progress as the reduction in the shortfall from an upper end. So the maximum is 10 or 100, and you start from 50 in a given period, is how much progress have you made compared to the maximum, which is 100. So the reduction in the shortfall is about 60%. So you could say that the glass is half full, but there is room to improve economic freedom. The second thing is that the progress that was made before World War I, and is particularly intense up to the early 1880s, was cut short and reversed during the first part of the 20th century. It's the interwar period, the two world wars, the the Great Depression. And the second thing I would say is that among these different dimensions, because, you know, the only justification for using an index is that you assume this is it's a latent variable. So you cannot measure directly economic freedom, but you can measure it indirectly through different dimensions. So at the end of the day, what you assume is that the sum of the different dimensions of economic freedom provide more information than each dimension considered individually. Okay, if you accept this, there is obviously a lot of people who wouldn't, you would say that it is also important to look at the components. So when you look at different components, my conclusion is that openness to international mobility of commodities and factors of production is the main driver of economic freedom, particularly after 1950. And also that within the OECD, there is a tendency for countries to converge. So there's a reduction in the distance of the country's level over time, but there is stability in their country ranking. So there is no absolute catch-up by, for instance, southern European countries.
So in terms of individual countries, then, you mentioned South European not converging. Who are the major achievers and underachievers in this group?
Since it's a long story, let me just give you a detail. The conventional wisdom is that common law countries are superior in terms of freedom compared to, you know, Roman law countries. So this would suggest, and this is, you know, what you find in Laporta and López Silanes and all this traditional work on institutions. So you would expect, you know, Canada, UK, the US would be on top. And my results are a bit surprising because common law tradition countries are good achievers and far better than southern European countries that remain at the bottom. You know, there might be small changes. But if you look at northwestern European countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, they are systematically at the top for each dimension, particularly Denmark. And this connects with the big idea in my project, which is determining whether there is a trade-off between positive and negative freedom. In my work on positive freedom, human development, Scandinavian countries are at the top. But now I find that Scandinavian countries are also at the top in terms of economic freedom. So for that, this is a bit counterintuitive result, is that, you know, you can oppose their good intellectual reasons to find a conflict between positive and negative freedom. But at the end of the day, in empirical and historical terms, what you find is that those countries who are freer in terms of negative freedom are also those countries that are freer in terms of positive freedom. So maybe the trade-off we find in the short run doesn't hold over the long run.
So moving on to some other work you've done. So in addition to economic liberty, are a number of other indicators of well-being or quality of life, you might say. You also considered health. Before we dig in, can you explain what the Preston curve is, and can you actually say something about what the concept of a health transition is?
Well, thank you. Now we go back to my previous project, although in this one, you know, one of the things I want to investigate is what is the association between economic freedom and well-being, because one of the implicit hypotheses, or sometimes explicit, in the relatively scant literature on economic freedom and everything else, is that, well, economic freedom improves the resource allocation, so that probably helps growth. But isn't it a trade-off between having more negative freedom and income and wealth distribution, or is a trade-off between negative freedom and well-being measure, for instance, by access to health and education and so on. So this work I've previously done is going to be used again in this case. And here, as you rightly pointed out, two major concepts that need to be addressed. One is the Preston curve. Samuel Preston, who's a very distinguished demographer, less well-known among economic historians, wrote a classical paper in 1975. He looked at the relationship between life expectancy and per capita income. He investigated the connections between these two variables for three cross sections in around 1900, 1930, and 1960. And he found a concave relationship between the two. In other words, you know, improvements in health proxied by life expectancy increased less than proportionally to income. But the main results, perhaps, is that this relationship was not static, was shifting outwards over time. So in 1960, the level was higher than in 1930, and 1930 higher than in 1900. So in other words, there was higher longevity for the same level of income as time went by. So this was a very challenging result because it you know, altered this one-to-one or this proportional relationship between health as a measure of well-being and income. And he related this differential behavior to, among other things, to non-income aspects, in particularly to the health or epidemiological transition, which is a transition by which persistent gains in terms of higher survival rates and lower mortality were achieved when the main cause of death stopped being infectious disease and became chronic disease. You know, infectious disease was, until the late 19th century in the world as a whole, the major cause of death. Then it started being chronic disease became the main driver of death in the West. But nowadays, a chronic disease is the main cause of death in the world, even in Africa. And this epidemiological transition origins are very interesting because this was triggered by the discovery and the diffusion of the so-called germ theory of disease. Previously, the idea was that infections were diffused through miasmas, through smells. But there was a series of discoveries by Pasteur, Koch, and different scientists in the 1870s, 1880s in Europe, in which they find that the diffusion of infectious disease is not just through vapors or smells or flavors, but through germs. You know? And this obviously sounds a very simple idea, but it was not spread throughout the world immediately. It took time. It didn't affect all regions simultaneously because obviously you need to have the acceptance of a society and to have the means to enforce these new ideas. So you need physical capital, you need human capital, you need social capital. I mean, you need a series of requisites to accept it. So it started in the late 19th century in Western Europe and in the US and spread gradually through other regions. From the 1920s onwards, that became a worldwide phenomenon. You know, I already talked at the beginning of why I was interested in looking beyond GDP. It's not because I don't trust GDP as a measure. I think it's important for material well-being. It's obviously there are lots of improvements you can do. You know, you take into account natural resources, destruction or climate impact and so on and so forth, GDP still, you know, is the best thing we have just for measuring material welfare. But if you look at very distinguished economists, they accept this idea that, you know, GDP is an informative indicator of welfare and is highly correlated with non-monetary dimensions of well-being. So my view is that it could be a happy coincidence. So we should go beyond that and see to what extent what is a correlation that perhaps holds in the very long run doesn't hold for different periods. And this is what I found, you know. Later on, what I find is that if you look at improvements in education, improvements in health, improvements in political and civil liberties, what you find is that over the long run, it is true. I mean, the 100 years or 170 years later, countries that are richer usually are healthier, more educated, and freer. But this is not an automatic relationship, and it doesn't hold for different periods. In fact, there are big discrepancies. So I would say it's intellectually lazy to just say, well, because they are highly correlated, let's settle for it. And I had an exchange with my old friend, Jan Lauten van Sanden, about this, because if you look at the approach that, for instance, OECD follows, what they use is a series of indicators and to measure well-being beyond GDP. But basically, the assumption is, well, GDP changes all. And there, these different indicators adjust more or less with a lag. But basically, you know, it's a kind of complementary information for what we already have with GDP. And I disagree. I think if you want to look at well-being, you have to look at other indicators. And since well-being is also a latent variable, you have to accept the idea of constructing an aggregate index, as I did. Most people in our profession would say GDP, with all the shortcomings, is the only way. I disagree.
So you mentioned some of the nuances you looked at. Let's just cut to your results then. What do your results reveal? Because you disagreed with that viewpoint of GDP as the best we have. What do your results reveal?
Let me just state the facts. Life expectancy at birth and per capita income in real terms differ in their trends and international distribution during different phases over the last 1.5 centuries. This is a fact. Maybe, you know, in the long run, improvements in one are matched by improvements in the other dimension, but this is not for different phases, different intensities, and it affects also the distribution, you know, because they improved at different pace. So the conventional view, as we have talked about, is that long-run improvements in life expectancy depend on economic growth and public provision of health. This is the conventional view in the sense that, you know, you're richer, so people are better fed, their immune system is stronger, so you live longer. But at the same time, you are richer and you can allocate more funds to the public provision of health. So this is obviously is true. But if you look at the world, you realize that things are not exactly like that. In fact, in places where the role of government was minor, where GDP per head didn't improve, where there was no public provision of health services, there has been a major improvement in life expectancy. And I'll give you a series of examples, starting from my own country. As you know, there was a civil war in Spain, 3 in the 19th century, 1 in the 20th century, from 36 to 39. And as a result of this, and there was a post-war period of autarky, so GDP per head in 1950 was basically similar at GDP in 1920, 30 years back. However, life expectancy at birth was 10 years longer in 1950 than in 1940. How come? Okay. You take as Jim Riley has studied, you take Jamaica. Jamaica in the 1930s was a stagnant colonial economy. Colonizers couldn't care much about the provision of public health for the natives, not only in Jamaica, but in Africa or in Asia, and life expectancy improved. In India, Tirthankar Roy has shown how stagnant the economy was until independence. However, life expectancy improved remarkably. And you find the same in sub-Saharan Africa from 1920 to 1960, at the time of independence. Life expectancy had improved. And we have detailed research showing that colonial powers didn't pay as much attention to inhabitants of their colony as they paid to inhabitants at the metropolis. So there is something else. And the something else is that there were advances in medical knowledge. And this helps explain why there was a sustained advance in life expectancy between 1920 and 1970. And because this period includes the globalization backlash, 1940, late 1940s, in which average incomes, as we all know, stagnated or declined. And there was a diffusion of health transition that drove trends in life expectancy, and not only trends in average life expectancy, but also trends in the distribution of life expectancy. So let me just add before I go to the connect with the Preston curve. These results, historical results, are completely at odds with a classical paper by Acemoglu and Johnson in the Journal of Political Economy, 2007, in which they talk about the international epidemiological transition, which is something that happens after World War II, from World War II onwards, and is related to the diffusion of new drugs, you know, antibiotics, then DDT, and is also connected to the work of international agencies. So the international epidemiological transition would have been, and this is the conventional wisdom among economists so far, was the result of advances in the West in medical technology and the diffusion through these agencies to the rest of the world. So it was something exogenous, so to speak. But if you look at the evidence, I just mentioned that during the first part of the 20th century, particularly from the 1920s to 1950, before antibiotics, before the emergence of international agencies, organizations working in the new independent countries in the third world, there had been a major advance. How come this be the case? So here, I will use as something that Easterling has reminded us a few years ago, but it was implicit in Preston's own work. Let's think in terms of a diagram in which on the vertical axis we have health, proxied by life expectancy at birth. In the horizontal axis, we have per capita income. Well, what people have in mind usually is a relationship between changes in levels of health and levels of income. As income increases, life expectancy increases. So what you would find is a kind of health function. So movements along this function are obviously associated to economic growth. Economic growth directly, because people are better fed and they are healthier. Economic growth indirectly through provision of public health. But what about what Preston found of outward shifts in the curve? Well, this is the role of technology. Okay, what Acemoglu and Johnson say, well, these shifts take place because of the diffusion of antibiotics, of new medicines and international agencies. However, these happens historically way before, happens if you compare levels of 1913 and 1950. There is a major outward shift. How come? Because most of the world, firstly, there were no antibiotics. You can mention that there were vaccines from the 1890s, then there were sulfa drugs from the 1930s, but most medicines were unaffordable. Remember a classical movie, Orson Welles' The Third Man. It's beautiful music, but it's about smuggling of penicillin. Because penicillin was terribly expensive. It was not affordable. In Madrid in the late 40s, early 50s, was a black market for penicillin. Only the well-to-do could afford it. So how come there is an outward shift in the function? And the reason is that we tend to forget that the germ theory of disease, this idea of how infectious disease spreads, has two practical effects. One is the research that leads to new drugs. The other one implies new behavior of people. People knows how, now know, once they know the cause, they start thinking about how to prevent it. So prevention of diffusion of the disease comes first. And for instance, once you know that the disease, infectious disease is diffused through germs, you know that washing your hands before eating or after going to the loo, or women resting after having deliveries, are ways of reducing the two major determinants in developing countries of life expectancy, which is maternal death and infant mortality. So that explains that in sub-Saharan Africa, before 1960, pre-independence, India, in the 1930s, Jamaica, or in Franco's early days, life expectancy was at odds with economic progress. So this is something that we have to remember, that outward shifts matter, but in early stages of economic development, they are associated to the diffusion of ideas that prevent the infectious disease to spread. So when we think about government activism and intervention in order to improve health, it's important to keep in mind that sometimes there is this exogenous element of medical knowledge that has an impact beyond what we can anticipate, okay? With respect to the difference between what I found and Preston, I'm confirming these historical outward shifts, but the major difference is that in his case, there is a concave association. So it means that improvements are less than proportional at income growth. In my case, what I found is that these functions, health functions, have a convex shape, suggesting that improvements in life expectancy are more than proportional as income reaches higher levels of income. And why is the difference? The difference is that he's using the original values of life expectancy. And these are, life expectancy is a bounded variable. So you cannot increase endlessly, and also is not adjusted for quality. So if you take into account that improvements in quality of life are closely associated to increases in quantity of life, this sounds odd because all of you have grandparents who are elderly but are in good shape. But what we tend to forget is that the proportion of years live in good health a low disability is a larger proportion of your lifespan. And even when you live in disability, you suffer much less than in previous periods. So what you have, and the interesting thing of this correlation, this association between increases in quality and in quantity of life, is that when life expectancy increases, this is not just a good proxy for the elderly. This means that the health for every cohort, including young and adolescents, has improved. And the same happens with education. So this is the quality element is very important. So my results are more optimistic because they show that health improves more than proportionally with income. Not only their outward shift, but this outward shift tend to be convex. I have exploring the association between not only health and income, but also education and then freedom and income. And you find that these shifts in the function take place with different intensities, with different evolution, also for education or for freedom. And it's very interesting when you get to 2020, because it has been a big decline in civil and political liberties in the world in the last 20 years. My hypothesis is that this would explain to a further extent why GDP per head is not a good predictor of well-being, because it's not a linear relationship in which you find movements along the function, but there are outwards and downward shifts. I mean, in the case of freedom, it's not just the classical modernization theory that the richer you are, the more democratic. No, you can have declines in freedom at higher income levels in different points in time. So it's a much more complex story, and I'm thinking about that.
Staying with that theme, Leandro, then, the fact that it's not so simple as we might once have thought. You brought, as you've just mentioned, some of them, many strands of well-being together in a study of inequality across nations over the period from 1870 to the present. You've mentioned some of them there, but what are the dimensions in the multidimensional nature of well-being that you considered?
When you go back to historical evidence, you realize, you know, one of my regrets is that I couldn't look at gender differences, because probably if you could look at gender differences, my findings would be highly qualified. Or, you know, I added civil and political liberties, which was, so there was voice and participation and so on. But for instance, something that today we are concerned, much more concerned than in the past, that what about climate? You know, this is not considered. So I realized that this is a tentative first step, but we need to add many other dimensions, and then probably there will be another set of dimensions we haven't taken into consideration. So I wanted to address questions such as, are our gains in well-being, just a few dimensions, better distributed today or more egalitarianly distributed than in the past? Is well-being inequality higher today than in the past? And what dimensions were driving it? Instead of looking to aggregates, what happens to the distribution, to the different percentiles or quartiles of deciles or of the distribution? So what I did was looking at three dimensions in a very crude way. One was health, another was education, another were liberties. But they were proxied by nonlinear transformations, as I said, in order to take into account their bounded nature and the lack of consideration of quality improvements in health and education. The indicators we have are life expectancy at birth and years of schooling. So they are very crude, purely quantitative indicators. So that's why I use this convex transformation. And then I use VDEM indicator of what they call liberal democracy, which is a combination of civil liberties and negative liberties and positive liberties. And on top of that, I added edge and weighted geometric average to proxy human development. These are the main dimensions.
So before we get into your results, Leandro, what's the standard narrative out there on dispersion of, say, GDP per head, the narrative of inequality, if you like, that's out there in the literature right now between countries?
We now have a picture that has been obtained by different authors, but perhaps the most recent and most distinguished and more thorough way of investigating has been Branko Milanović. And the picture we get now is that the inequality of per capita income was increasing until the mid-20th century, even until the late 20th century, and declined only at the very end of the 20th century, and now has been declining. But we're still far away from the low levels of inequality in the early 19th century, for instance. And I'm just quoting Branko Milanović. They're having different ways of approaching inequality. One is looking at inequality between countries, the average, assuming that all the inequality is between countries and there is no inequality within countries. I mean, ignoring what happens within national boundaries. And remember, in the 1990s, the literature on convergence was not only looking at countries' averages, but giving the same weight to every country. Luxembourg and China counted the same. This is what Milanović called inequality one. There is a second inequality, which is inequality two, in which you still ignore what happens within national boundaries, but you weight countries by the size of their population. This obviously has a disadvantage, is that you blur the impact of domestic policies, but has an advantage, is that you're approaching better what happens to the world citizen, because China matters much more, or India, because most of the human race lives there. And there is the third measure, it is the one in which you take into account not only inequality between countries, but also inequality within countries. So this, for instance, Sally Martin many years ago did it, Milanović has done it. Basically, this idea that inequality has increased, global inequality and population-weighted inequality. In my case, I only look at inequality to a population-weighted inequality. I don't have information for such a long time span for inequality for each these dimensions within national boundaries. So I acknowledge the shortcoming, and I would claim that this is, in the best of the cases, a lower bound of what actually happens to inequality. But basically, inequality two and global inequality tell the same story for per capita income. They go up to the late 19th century. It's faster than Greece up to 1950, then stabilize but continue growing, and then they fall from 1990 onwards to the present. And this is the good news.
Having set out the example of what happens across income inequality, which is basically across those two measures, income inequality rises and kind of steadies out and starts to fall after 1990 between nations. What variables were you looking at when you tried to measure inequality across countries?
Let me insist in that I cannot do what Milanović or Bourguignon and Morison do, because they look not only to inequality between countries, weighted by population, but also they look at inequality between and within countries. I settle for the easiest measurement of population-weighted inequality between countries. I did two things. And the first one was just replicating what they have been done for per capita income. And I found something interesting. I found that in the case of schooling, in the case of life expectancy, there was a sustained decline that was particularly intense between the 1920s and the 1980s. In the case of education, inequality starts from the late 19th century. In the case of life expectancy, inequality is declined steadily from the 1920s. And they tend to reach a trough in around 1980, the early 1980s. But it's more intense probably between the 1920s up to the 1970s. In the case of freedoms, this is different, because there is an increase in inequality in terms of civil and political liberties from the 1920s to the 1970s. And only after the 1970s, there is a decline. So it's very interesting to look at what drives this different behavior. If you combine them in an unweighted way, look at human development augmented with civil and political liberties, what you find is a long-term decline for the last 100 years.
In inequality.
Right, in inequality. So, in other words, the decline in social dimensions of well-being, such as health and education, more than offset the increase in inequality in civil and political liberties, and then they are reinforced with the decline in civil and political liberties from 1970 onwards. So you could say that the aggregate results are optimistic because from the 1920s to the present, there has been a sustained decline in inequality. But if you look at different components of well-being, you find a more optimistic story in terms of education, then in terms of life expectancy, and then in terms of civil liberties.
So you explained some of the trends there, but what were the major drivers of the rises and falls in inequality over the period, if you could summarize some?
First, you can here think in terms of what is the inequality between two main groups, what you would say the core or OECD countries and the rest, and what is the inequality within each of these two groups. Because, you know, part of the debate is to what extent the core or the West or the OECD is pulling ahead and the rest of the world is falling behind. Well, when you look at inequality, what you find is that only partially and only until mid-20th century, the gap between the core and the periphery or the core and the rest of the world matters, is the main driver. From the mid-20th century, the main driver is the dispersion within developing regions. So it's not just a simple story in which everything is driven by the gap between the rich and the poor in the world, because there is a lot of action happening in the rest of the world. The other thing I did before I enter into different dimensions is that I look at something that has been explored, among others, by Branko Milanović, looking what he calls growth incidence curves, which is instead of looking at averages such as the Gini or the MLD or tail indicators, you look at what happens to different deciles or ventiles of the distribution. In my case, it's a distribution by countries. And then what you find is that on average, the middle and the lower deciles are those who get a relatively larger improvement. In the case of education, the improvement is mainly for the bottom, for the poorest, or for the lowest deciles. In the case of life expectancy, is the middle and the lower declines. So this confirms the aggregate story told in terms of the Gini or in terms of MLD. Then if we look at what happens to different indicators, you get something interesting. The globalization of educational and health practices have a major impact in the reduction of inequality. And this explains why education inequality has declined so much and why has declined during the interwar period. I mean, this period of backlash from 1914, 1950 was a period of globalization of educational practices. It's education before government activism takes place around the world. So it happens already before African colonies became independent in the 1920s or in the 1960s, or Asian colonies became independent in the after 1950. It accelerated after that. But there is a tendency to this globalization of educational practices, in which obviously primary education plays a major role. In the case of life expectancy, as I said, the story is more complex. And I'll tell you why. Because this first health or epidemiological transition, as I said, was unevenly distributed because not all societies were as open or had the means to implement the solutions suggested by the germ theory of disease. So initially, inequality in terms of health increased. And that increased up to the 1920s. Up to 1920, up to World War I and its aftermath. And only then is when it becomes to spread around the world. So there is a part of increasing inequality that is due to the fact that these advances, not only in terms of medical technology, but in terms of medical dissemination of medical knowledge, spreads unevenly. And then there is a big decline from 1920 to the 1970s. And then there is a stagnation and even some reversal in the late 20th and 21st century. Why? The obvious explanation is, well, there is the demise of socialism in a part of the world. So as socialism declines, people are less protected as before. And then if you look at the mid-1990s, you say, well, HIV AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa is a major driver. But it's not only that. It's not the demise of socialism. It's not HIV AIDS pandemics. There is something else. And the fact is that there is a second health transition. This second health transition is so far related to the advanced world. And this second health transition has to do with fighting off cardiovascular, respiratory, and sight disease. And it's also helped by having had a healthy childhood and adolescence in advanced countries. So this, again, requires, I mean, people would say, well, the first epidemiological transition was much cheaper to implement. Well, perhaps, but I'm not so sure, because obviously sanitation works were not free. They required a lot of effort, in financial effort. So now to implement a second health transition in developing countries implies that people smoke less, people take care of what they eat, and they eat less red meat, and so on and so forth, and has to do with levels of income. But what is the implication? That perhaps once there is the second health transition spreads, there will be another fast decline in health inequality. And the last element I would like to emphasize is what happens to civil and political liberties, inequality. And here, again, they behave differently, because not only freedoms worsen between the 1920s and the 1970s, geopolitics, the power of hegemonic powers matters. British influence in the 19th century, the role of the US, particularly after World War II, so this matters as well. So if you look at what happens in terms of liberties, you have this worsening between the central years of the 20th century and improvement in liberties after that. And if you look at what happened to distribution, it's a very much the same picture. So you would say that only after 1970, inequality declines in terms of civil liberties. Of course, the 21st century is a big question mark, because we have observed that liberties are threatened in so-called liberal democracies, even in advanced part of the world, not to mention in developing countries. It's difficult to predict. While you can easily predict that education inequality and life expectancy inequality will continue declining in the case of this other important dimension, it's a bit problematic. But even though there is the issue of deepening the quality of education and the quality of health.
So to summarize, Leandro, you would say that your indicators of well-being, whether you combine them or whether you look at them individually, they don't behave at all as one would expect if one was going by the GDP per capita measures well-being narrative.
Yes, this is a better way of summarizing what I was trying to say. Of course, this is compatible with saying that over the long run, you get improvements in both per capita income and well-being broadly defined. But of course, if you just focus on per capita income, as people do with this panel data they use at the World Bank or OECD, that tend to just qualify per capita income, you're missing a great part of the story. My main conclusion, I think, is that if we really believe that well-being is multidimensional, we cannot just pay lip service to this idea and then go back to GDP per head, business as usual.
Well, Leandro, I've really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for your invitation.